Chapter 49.
I am the Emperor's hand. Do not thou persist in this combat. Matchless am I with the long blade.
Ortus Nigenad's voice reverberated around that ice-rimed, organ-swagged facility like one of the sleeper's gunshots. The great body, the one that Harrowhark had in her crueler youth assumed would look best once the man was dead and his bones settled in the family monument, proved to possess a pair of lungs that could declaim to wake the dead. Abigail's voice rose with his, though hers was desperate and somewhat wild.
Nigenad, you think too much of me.
Never, lady. Matchless alike in my magecraft. Fall to your knees and be glad that I spare thee. Thy courage is mighty.
Book 5. Harrowhark's least favourite.
Oh, God, she heard Abigail say. God, please help me.
Heavy, booted steps approached the coffin. Harrow dared not poke her head around its bulk, and anyway, she knew what she would see. Instead, she scattered a fistful of crushed ash in a wide half-circle around herself and Ortus and raised it into a jagged wall of calvarial bone, 6 feet high and an inch thick, the toughest and thickest posterior parietal she could manage in her pre-lictoral state. The shell absorbed some of the force of Ortus's declamation, rendering it flatter and less thunderous, but it was still impressively resonant as he continued,
Mightier yet is thy folly, if thou think'st yet to oppose me. The lictor spoke and was silent.
The bone fence shattered. It was impossible. Harrow now clearly remembered the wall of bone she had summoned up around herself, Gideon and Camilla Hecht, in those dreadful final moments on the garden terrace. She had been almost spent, and yet her barrier had held off a determined onslaught by one of the Emperor's fists and gestures for at least a minute. Kithareia had been 10,000 years old and heir to limitless necromantic power. The sleeper had a baggy orange suit and a gun collection. Yet now she shouldered her way through Harrow's wall with irritable, disgusted motions, as if it were an unexpected curtain of cobweb in a catacomb archway. The bone barely even seemed to break. It simply flaked away in chunks, like old plaster from a ceiling. The sleeper forced her upper body through the crumbling wreckage, gun thrust out before her, and shot Ortus in the belly. Ortus reflexively clutched at the wound, and everything went very still. He took his bloody hand away and stared at it as though awed. Harrow looked from the hole in his abdomen, small and neat as though drilled there, to his face, and then to the sleeper, still wedged halfway through that absurd torn rift in what should have been solid bone. The gun sent up a curl of smoke, and that has-covered face revealed nothing. Her cavalier cleared his throat again and said, faltering, working that huge, resonant bellow,
Nonius, wound!
He had to swallow.
Nonius, wounded!
But he managed no more. Harrowhark's heart crumpled like foil. She latched on to the ripped edges of her wall and drove outward, hard, hurling the sleeper backward off her feet and through the air. The shattered lumps of debris she spun upward into constructs. So easy, even now, easy since she'd been a child. 1, 2, 3, 4 clattering skeletons flinging themselves onto the attacker to rip and wrench with fleshless hands. The sleeper was on her feet to meet them. She shot the first through the skull, and the whole body resolved into ash, which was not how it worked. Did the same to the second. The third managed to lay hold of her free arm before it got a bullet through its spinal column and crumbled into garbage. Harrow's ears pounded, and her head throbbed, and her skin felt wet, and she dragged up 4 more to follow them. She did not know why Ortus had to go mad now, but when the 9th house advanced, its reverend daughter would advance with it. She roared, her voice not so much a ringing trumpet as it was a howling alarm.
Nonius wounded full sore, spat blood and gave him a grim smile, nor did the sword in his hand shake.
From behind her, Autus said weakly,
Hera.
Boldly he answered the saint, 'Tis true that—'
And there she hesitated. Nonius's responses were generally where she began to think about anything else in the whole universe. She became aware that Abigail was chanting. Her voice did not betray any fear, nor sense of desperation. The words melted together like wax beading on an edge of a candle, sublimating into pale liquid, resolving into beads that stuck midway down the taper. Harrow caught her plea, distracted.
When I come into my homeland, my family will sacrifice in their halls for you, the best of all our blood, the freshest, the best of all our blood, the oldest.
As Harrow floundered, Autus whispered,
Your power is great.
She continued hastily,
Your power is great, O servant of masterful Canaan, nor may I hope to be counted your equal in skill, nor in craft, nor even in bodily vigour.
The sleeper smashed a last skeleton into powder with a blow from her gloved fist that looked almost dismissive. It's over, she said, and aimed the gun at Harrow's head. The candles burst forth in chrysanthemum flames of blue, fully 6 feet high. Time seemed to gel, and Harrow, hands outflung, watched the bones she had scattered pause in midair like falling white stars. The fire wailed upward. She swept her gaze across the room. There lay Magnus and Dias and Protesilaus, still where they had been felled. There was Dulcie Septimus, propping herself up in a doorway with wide and violent eyes. And there was... Abigail Pent blazed like a flare from a blue and alien sun. Long prominences of light trailed from her fingers. It seemed as though she held in her hands a book with all the pages fleshed from that same azure radiation. Amid that frantic cold, Harrow saw that Abigail was soaking wet, wreathed in hot mist-like shimmers by spirit magic. She had thrust off her jacket and her mittens and stood there in just a dress and her robe and bare arms. A reek hit Harrow like a faceful of snow, water, brine, blood. A multitude of voices lifted up in Abigail's and screamed. Glutinous time unglued. There was a crack as the sleeper fired and a sharp metal spang, and nothing hit Harrow in the head. A shadow rose before her, and it was all the shadows of the room. The candles were no longer columns of great blue light, but had sunk to billowing black flames. She was frozen by the sound of a great bell. Blablang, blablang, blablang. The first bell of Dreaber, of the House of the Ninth, sounded loudly in that laboratory atrium, and a figure stood between Harrow and the sleeper. The figure wore a cuirass of black laminate that had not been favoured by the cohort for years and years. Fibre armour, matte and unpolished, shadowy, rather than shining obsidian, with small overlapping plates layered across its surface. The rest of the armour was more timeless, black canvas breeches tucked into black greaves of leather and plex, and the stiff, unpretentious frieze hood of Dreaber, not worn up, but loose on the neck. Worn-out black polymer mitts, no more sophisticated than griddles. In one of those gloved hands was a rapier of lightless black metal with a plain guard and hilt, though from that hilt clanked delicate rows of knucklebone prayer beads, terminating in what was unmistakably, even by candlelight, a carving of the jawless skull. In the other hand was a simple black metal dagger, its blade thrust out horizontally a few feet in front of Harrow's face, where it had blocked the sleeper's bullet mid-flight. The new arrival turned its head to look from the sleeper to Harrow. In those black and spitting flames, what she could see of the face was quite ordinary. Dark, drear hair, cut fairly short but not sacramentally shorn. The skull paint was cursory in the extreme, a few lines painted along the bottom jaw and chin, the merest suggestion of teeth and mandible. The flames guttered around Abigail Pent. She looked terrified, uplifted, and openly astonished. She looked far away, as though she were no longer even truly with them. Her spectacles had slipped off her nose, and in that blazing blue corona her eyes were dark and liquid and feral. The House of the Fifth always skinned itself over with such airs of civilization, with so many manners and niceties. But they were spirit talkers, and speakers to the dead, and the dead were savage. The sleeper stepped away and lowered her gun. "Ninth was my name," said the new arrival. "Ninth was my hearth and my homeland. Here have I come at your calling. None may return from the river unless he be bidden by bloodright. Tell me, why have I been drawn here?" And Abigail said, "I speak your name, Matthias Nonius, cavalier of the Ninth House. I charge you to protect the reverend daughter of Dreaber and to slay her enemies." "Waste not your breath," said the ghost of Matthias Nonius. "Such was my task when I lived. Why now in my death would I need a reminder?" Harrowhark said, mostly to herself, "Oh, God." As the newcomer spoke, he had circled very slightly to the right, away from Harrow. The sleeper had kept her gun trained on him the whole time, cautiously, as though waiting to see what he would do. Now she fired, and Nonius moved. In one long, liquid evolution, he seemed to flatten and extend himself. His whole body became a single smooth device for deploying his rapier's blade, like a needle flicking out of a spring housing. The point bit into one orange flank, and the sleeper stumbled backward. From this new tear, Harrow saw dark liquid trickle. Nonius's body folded back into place somehow, his rapier held with the hilt low and the tip pointing up at his opponent's face. He resumed his slow circular drift. "A tool for a killer of beasts," he said. "What warrior wields such a weapon in honourable service of combat? Has dignity wholly departed the houses since I saw the starlight? Or are you some raider or cutthroat?" "You're just a ghost like the rest of them," said the sleeper. But this time the flat voice that emanated from the hazmask carried a tinge of disbelief. "You don't get special rules." "In life I was only a man," the ghost agreed. "But the Ninth House granted me honour and made me unworthy its servant. I speak with the voice of the tomb, and my strength is the strength of the Black Gate. Why am I talking in meter?" The sleeper fired twice, but the sword flicked up diagonally across Nonius's body, hilt at his face, before Harrow had even heard the shots. One bullet ricocheted off into the darkness. The other seemed to hit the armor, and Nonius jerked slightly with the impact. But again, the blade shot out so fast and sure that the movement hardly made sense to the eye. The sleeper sounded a muffled curse through the face mask and dropped her weapon, which clattered on the tiles. Then she snatched back her hand and brought it out from behind her back, holding a significantly longer and fatter gun. This one had a blunt, squat barrel that even to Harrow's untrained eye looked like bad news. The sleeper braced it in both hands against her shoulder, pointed at Nonius's face. "Go back to hell," she said, and pulled the trigger. There was a flat metallic snap, and nothing happened. She pulled again. Nothing. She threw the gun to the side, and before it had even hit the floor, it had been replaced with a long, elegant rifle. This yielded a hollow clunk and a distinct lack of anything else. The sleeper backed away a few more steps, her plex mask as impassive as ever. Nonius followed, not closing the distance, but matching it, echoing her movements.
You ought to look after them better, he suggested.
I killed wizard's filth like you all my life, snarled the sleeper. This time the object that appeared in her hand was not a gun. It was some sort of fat cylinder. She flicked it downward, and a slim black baton, perhaps 3 feet in length, telescoped suddenly outward with a noise like a bolt going home. I killed them with guns and bombs and knives and gas, and when I didn't have any of those, I just got in real close and put my thumbs through their fucking eyes. You can flick that little skewer around all you like, boy. I'll choke you with it.
I certainly hope you're a fighter, said Nonius, and raised his dagger hand. God knows you're not a debater.
They both lunged forward at once. As the first crack of plex or metal sounded, Harrow dropped next to Ortus. She grasped him with her hands and with a pair of skeletal arms for good measure and started to haul him to safety. He did not help. He was too busy watching. Much like Abigail, he was transported, not to some kind of ancestral state of primeval ghost worship, but to a wide-eyed heaven only he understood. She had never seen Ortus look triumphant. She had never seen Ortus in the eye of any storm of his own making. She said urgently, "What did you do?"
"Oh, I did nothing," he said breathlessly. Pent is a marvel. I will write songs for Pent.
Write them later, and hurry up now.
If I die my final death here, he said, I will die knowing the only happiness that I have ever known.
Oh, shut up and move, she said desperately. If all of her cavaliers were this excited for death, she was definitely the problem. He did not move. He was smiling.
You were part of the miracle, Harrowhawk. Your emphasis was almost perfect.
He smiles grimly at least 20 times in that act alone, Nigenad, she snapped. Find a new collocation. It turned out that a relatively small amount of Thanagy was all she needed to staunch the blood from his wound. His major organ function was stable enough, whatever that meant exactly, where a ghost was concerned, and she didn't want to mess around with complex tissue repair in these circumstances. Harrow's early training had taken place in freezing, poorly lit crypts, and still this particular crypt seemed unhelpfully dark and unmanageably cold. Having propped Ortus against a wall a safe distance from the action, she turned to see what had happened to the others. The surviving necromancers and cavaliers, whom she had to remind herself were here precisely because they had not survived, were arranged silently around the room's perimeter. Abigail was sitting on the floor, still a coruscating blue flame, and her husband had his arm around her and was leaning heavily into her with a face taut with pain. Neither of them watched with any particular joy, but with a hungry intent, a cold anticipation. Dulcinea and Protessa Laus had crawled to each other, leaving long snail trails of blood behind them, to meet exhausted at a point in the middle. Only the lieutenant had managed to stand, with the stiff-backed and impassive precision of a woman on a parade ground watching a drill. She looked as though at any moment she might blow a whistle for halt. Harrow suspected a whistle would not be enough to halt this particular duel. It was like nothing she had ever seen at Canaan House, not even like the practice bouts on the Mithraeum, which had been inhumanly fast and skillful, but somehow bloodless, more dances than fights. These were two people who had spent their lives doing nothing but fighting, now freed from the shackles of flesh and time, focusing their entire selves on the business of murdering each other. If Gideon had been there. No. If Gideon had been there, Harrow still couldn't have hoped for a running commentary. Griddle didn't know how to do running commentary. She would suck her breath through her teeth or mutter in ecstasy words that meant nothing to anyone who wasn't her. Things like, right foot, in tones that suggested that if she died on the spot, that right foot would have somehow been the apex of her existence. Nor could she ever explain a fight after the fact in terms that Harrow could understand. But if her cavalier had been there, Harrow was fairly sure that she would have sucked her molars out of their sockets from sheer intensity of feeling. Gideon, watching this single combat, might have better appreciated the anonymous monster called the Sleeper for what she truly was. In life, she must have had few, if any, equals. Her people, whoever they had been, must have cherished her as their finest champion. She was a prodigious fighter. Fast, brutal, ruthless in exploiting advantages, terrifying in her force and aggression. She had gained a wicked-looking knife with a serrated edge in her left hand, balancing the baton in her right, and she struck with it at eyes, groin, or anywhere else she could reach. The heavy haz suit did not seem to slow her at all, and she had a cat-like agility in keeping with her earlier handspring. She kept swerving her body away from strikes and mixing elbow jabs, knee strikes, and even kicks into her overall assault. There was no trace in her of the beribboned show fighter. She fought like she wanted to kill you, and she hoped it would hurt. And her opponent was Matthias Nonius. 1,000 years ago, Dreaber had produced Matthias Nonius. He had not become Cavalier Primary until very late. More correctly, he should have been Matthias the Ninth. But Harrowhark had never heard anyone refer to him that way. He had never been described to her as anything other than the greatest swordsman of our house. He was rather short of stature, arms averagely long. Neither of those was correct, surely. Ortus had always given the impression he was perhaps 7 feet tall and 3 feet wide. Nonius's ghost had emerged from the fog of legend, looking more like a meek priest than a warrior. But with the sword in his hand, a black prayer-wreathed blade of her house, and his offhand knife in the other, the type of simple black blade carried by chaplains or nuns, he was a poem. He was absurdly still, which he thought was against the rules of all rapier swordplay. He stood lightly in place, feet positioned hips-width apart, and the Sleeper would pummel at him, take that black cosh and whip it cruelly at his ribs, gouge that long knife upward toward his inner thigh, and no blow would land. Nonius calmly parried them away as though he'd studied a list of the moves to come. It did not even seem to take him effort to block the lightning action of the knife, or of the club, or of the kick. He just stood there, with the black candle flame gleaming off ebony steel, and made himself a barricade. And then he would move. He had lift Harrowhark had never seen in a human being, as though gravity changed its rules for him. His movements were never hasty or choppy. He would give all he had to one beautiful fall of the sword, and the Sleeper would begin to bleed. There were fully 6 slits torn in her suit now, and all of them were smeared with red. But she neither stopped nor slowed, and gradually it was wearing him down. Nonius always did wear down in long fights. From books 1 to 4, he was matchless. His enemies died if he looked at them. But later, Ortus had seen fit to add long specific duels between his god and a few named and honourable rivals. If a foe got a hit in on Nonius, it was a good indicator that they would be present for at least the next 10 pages, even if half of that was talking. The Sleeper smashed her baton down on Nonius's skull with enough force to stave it in. Nonius stepped clear and kicked her in the outside of the knee, sending her stumbling for balance, and took the opportunity to lash a clean line down her thigh with his rapier's tip. Blood spattered the floor. As he slid back into guard, Harrow saw that his clothes had changed. The bright orange hazsuit had somehow become a suit of fibre duelling armour, much like Nonius's own, with a padded cuirass sporting several blood-stained gashes and a set of plex amalgam greaves. The ensemble was still the same warning orange colour, which produced a very strange effect. The blank hood with its faceplate was now a peculiar curved mask of what looked like deep gold, wrought in stylized likeness of a proud face with a beaked nose and slitted holes for eyes. Only the knife and baton remained unaltered. Bewildered, she looked up to find the room was changing too. The nine-sided structure was the same, doorways in every wall and the great coffin at the center. But the doorways were now arched and ceremonial rather than squared off and industrial. The dark metal panels had become dark stone blocks of a familiar type, although the floor, with its ring of candles and the remains of its diagram, was still of metal tile patched with frost. Some of the fleshy webbing clung on the walls, but in places it had vanished, along with the signs it had covered. In the corner between two arches, there now hung a single ragged black banner, emblazoned in white with the jawless skull. It was no specific hall on Dreaba that Harrow had ever set foot in, but it was unmistakably a room of the ninth house. By our very presence in the river, we briefly exert space on non-space. The struggle for control backstage is leaking over into the action out front. She had been once again so slow. The sleeper had found herself unable to use her firearms because there weren't any firearms in the Noniad. Ortis disdained them. Even the nameless enemy soldiers Nonius faced were always described as wielding spears or clubs. Just as the force of the sleeper's hatred had translated into unreasonable strength against Harrow's necromancy, the power to smash through solid walls and turn constructs into dust with her bare hands, now the force of Nonius's devotion to the ninth, refracted through the prism of Ortis's accursed poem, was overwriting the sleeper's rules. Even the wounds, she realized with a start, were correct. Whenever Nonius faced a serious opponent, both parties always ended up running with blood from a series of largely cosmetic wounds. In one pivotal duel in Book 9, Nonius and a rival cavalier fought for a full hour, both bleeding heavily the entire time, and at the end simply shook hands and exchanged epigrams on valour rather than jointly passing out from hypervolemic shock. The sleeper had seized control of Harrow's staged memory, the story her brain was telling itself about Canaan House, and used it to prosecute her guerrilla war against the Nine Houses. Now Matthias Nonius, or at least Ortis Nigenad's version of Matthias Nonius, was trying to turn it into an epic poem. He was not altogether succeeding. The space was in flux. As Harrow watched, the floor beneath her feet began shimmering into close-set slabs of black lacquered stone, but the slabs faded like mist almost as soon as they appeared, and the metal tiles returned. The sleeper whipped her baton into the side of Nonius's face, sending him staggering, and followed up with a vicious knife thrust to his belly. He turned it with the thick part of his blade, but awkwardly, and the sleeper managed to knee him in the flank and score the knife's point down his sword arm for good measure before he shoved her away and fell back into guard. They paused, breathing hard. Blood showed plainly on the bizarre orange armour, blooming in startling curls and petals. Less so on the black Dreaba leathers, but the floor around Nonius's feet was spattered red. The sleeper's golden mask remained smooth and perfect, whereas Nonius had gained a gash down his cheek and a split lip. "Few have I fought so ferocious. To match you in arms is to stand against fully 100 unworthy," he said, which was exactly the kind of thing he was supposed to say. "You're good, but you're just another fucking zombie," she said, which wasn't. The voice still sounded husky and blurred, even without the Hazsuit mouthpiece. "Who was your master in life? Whose banner and blade did you bear?" he asked. Nonius always displayed an unhealthy curiosity about the people trying to kill him. "What mission compels you to face me?"
"My master in life was revenge," said the sleeper. "My mission is one of... God damn it! I'm not going to start talking like this."
"Enter the river with pride," he said, and there was something genuinely sad in his voice. "Go back to its turbulent waters. Fain would I spare such a fighter." She rushed him, low and fast. The baton rang against his sword, and she struck upward with her knife, as if to impale his throat. But she flipped the blade somehow in her hand as it came, so his parry with the dagger caught empty air. The butt of her knife struck him under the chin, snapping his head back. A long, slender filigree of blood sprayed from his mouth and hung in the air for what seemed like half a second too long. Even as he fell back, his failed parry flexed in the space between them and flicked past her ribs, the dagger's tip trailing a thin and perfect arc of red. Across the room, beyond the duel, Harrow saw Dulcie Septimus trying to limp out the doorway. Her cavalier, who had propped himself upright against its frame, shot out an arm and pulled her back, sparking indignant outrage on her face. He glanced at Autus, and they gave each other a grim, soldierly little nod of understanding. Harrow murmured, "Septimus has the right idea. If I raise a construct now, close in on the sleeper from behind, Dias wasn't badly hurt, and she still has her sword."
"Nonius doesn't fight in a crowd," Autus said tightly.
"Nigenet, you do realize this is not literally a poem."
"You saw what happened to the guns," he said. "Rules are everything here, Harrowhark. If we break them, I am certain we are lost."
Harrow gnawed her lip. The more ragged and brutal the fight became, the more it seemed to favour the sleeper. Nonius could not get the space to bring his rapier properly to bear. He was increasingly holding it against his body, using it more like a shield than the scalpel she knew it was meant to be. The floor between the fighters was one great smear of blood in which their feet skidded for purchase. As Harrow watched, Nonius did something clever with his dagger, and one of the sleeper's strikes flew wide. She lost her footing for a moment, and he took the opportunity to step back, free the sword, turn it for a thrust. She brought the baton down on the inside of his elbow with all the graceless force of a butcher chopping meat. Nonius cried out, and the black rapier of Dreaber fell from nerveless fingers and clanged to the floor. She stepped in close, drew her head back, and smashed her golden mask into his unprotected face with a dreadful crunch. He reeled backward and half fell against the empty coffin, his newly free hand coming up to his eyes. The sleeper advanced, her mask's impassive gaze twisted into a sneer by fresh blood. "Fancy footwork, shitbird," she said, and raised the knife. Matthias Nonius came off the coffin like the Emperor's wrath. He crashed into her bodily, driving her back, and then swung his knife at her exposed side. She blocked it with the baton, and he kneed her in the gut, grabbed the back of her head in his empty hand, and kneed her again in the throat. They grappled. Harrow could hear her coughing wetly through the mask, and she managed to shoulder him away. But he came straight back in with a knife slash that nearly unstitched her guts. Harrow caught a glimpse of his face, now mostly blood. His nose was broken, and his lips and chin were wet with gore. There was blood in his eyes and under his hair, and his expression was one of cold and perfect murder. It was as though losing the rapier had snapped some invisible shackle. He didn't even look angry. He looked like an ending given human form. The sleeper struck out with the baton. He grabbed her arm, twisted, and brought his elbow's point down hard. The arm snapped wetly. Then he caught her by the back of the neck like he was pulling her in for a kiss and jammed his dagger into her belly. She dropped her knife, which joined her baton on the tiles, and seized his throat with both hands. He drove her all the way back against the wall, and they wrestled there for a second. Then he broke free of her hold and stumbled clear, leaving the black dagger's hilt protruding obscenely from the orange fabric at her gut. As she grasped it with her hand and tried to pull it free, Protesilaus VII left his doorway and came forward a few steps. He had detached his sheathed sword from its belt, and he flung out his arm and sailed the whole thing through the air. Nonius caught the exquisitely patterned scabbard in one bloodied hand. He drew the lovely sword of the rose unblown, and as the sleeper dragged herself off the wall, brandishing the dagger, which steamed with her blood, he ran his blade through her heart. He skewered the sleeper up to the hilt, and as she fell, jerking, he slid down to the ground with her, supporting her with his other arm. Only when the sleeper stopped moving did he withdraw the sword with a silken wet whisper. The candles flared with a last burst of black flame and then sank to a glimmer. All around them, there were sounds like sausages flung from a height as the draped tubes and ligaments fell to the ground, bouncing damply before dissolving into pinkish powder. The icicles fell one by one, slush before they hit the tiles. There was a humming noise and a plink, and the electric lights in the ceiling came suddenly on, pouring down blank white light, the unkindness of hot filament. Harrowhart crossed over and crouched down next to the ghost swordsman of her house as he gently prized the mask from the sleeper's face. The features were slack now. They were smeared with blood from nose and mouth, but not otherwise obscured by damage. A bound back mass of hair had been tucked into the collar, but some strands and wisps had escaped and plastered themselves in red whorls on the forehead and cheeks. That dead, proud, unforgiving face beheld them all until Nonius closed the sightless eyes, and Harrowhark was bewildered. She did not understand. The blue flames no longer licked at Abigail's palms and skirts. She kneeled on the hard metal grill, careless of discomfort, and she asked, "Harrow, do you know her?" The sleeper had the unmistakable face of the portrait in the shuttle on the planet she had killed. The woman plastered behind Corona and Judith, the familiar woman with the pitiless eyes, had fought to usurp Harrowhark's soul. "Not at all," she said. Nonius pushed himself to stand. He wiped the borrowed sword on his thigh, turning the blade this way and that, then presented it to Protesilaus, who was either supporting Dulcie or being supported by her. It wasn't clear, and it was ridiculous either way. "'Tis dirtier than it deserves," he said. "Such a blade would I sooner return with better than blood, and my best thanks." Protesilaus said, "I wish that my whole house knew of my privilege. If I lived again, I would advise all the Seventh to travel to Drieber if they sought instruction in the art. If I had but 5 minutes of life again, I would spend them praising you. I would speak of nothing but my reverence for you and the Ninth House and its nonpareil swordplay."
"I'd call that a waste of 5 minutes," muttered his necromancer, sotto voce. Harrowhark's cavalier was smirking with barely concealed glee.
"My lady," Nonius said. He had turned toward her. He neatly bowed. She bowed back and said,
"I hope that your bones are blessed in the Anastasian for your service."
"My bones fell far from home," said the cavalier with a faint smile. "Never, I think, will a wanderer happen upon where they now lie, far though he travel. 'Tis blessing enough that I see such a reverend daughter, and know that my house stands stalwart and dauntless, proud in the face of its foes. But I still don't know why I'm talking in meter." Ortus was saying to Abigail.
Lady, it's you who should be praised. Your act of necromancy should reverberate through the nine houses like the dying refrain of a song. I would that I were still alive, so that I could complete my great work and begin the next one afresh, and call it the Pentiad, and perhaps alternate between 5-foot and 9-foot verses, a total departure from my first work, but reflective of it. I would make you the poem, Lady Abigail, that you already are.
I did ask you to stop flirting with my wife, said Magnus, and at Ortis's face said instantly, Joke, man, joke! Do they not have them on the 9th? That would explain a lot. Ortus, Abigail said gravely. This was the first time Harrow had ever seen her even slightly disarrayed. Her hair, normally brushed to mirror smoothness, looked as though she had been dragged backward through the os. She was wet with sweat. She kept rubbing her hands discreetly, and Harrow saw that they were singed. Ortus, it should not have worked. We had no right to call the soul of Matthias Nonius. Your sword had no viable link to him. We had no thanagetic connection. We had nothing but the manuscript you gave me, in which I took the liberty of correcting a few spellings. I hope you don't mind. Harrowhark was certain Pent had no idea how terribly she had just wounded Ortis's gratitude to her. Looking at the brief, stricken expression that crossed his face, it would perhaps have been kinder to make him eat the book. I find myself in the astonishing position of having created a revenant link through, well, sheer passion. That revenant turned to Ortis now. Standing together, Ortis towered head and shoulders above him. Harrow expected that same stricken horror to show on her cavalier's face. But as Ortis looked at the ghost he had spent his whole life worshipping, yet another thing she and he had in common, he flushed deeply.
I am unworthy, he said simply.
Clearly that cannot be true, said Matthias Nonius. If the fifth speaks aright, if your art was the anchor that rendered me whole here and gave me a body and blade for the battle, your art, not my strength, was the ultimate source of our victory. Harrow looked away. From far off in the facility, there were more sounds, of melting ice, of snapping viscera. She found her layered robes heavy. So were the others, and they shed coats and gloves even as she watched. The air felt lighter. That reeking fog had gone. As she unwound lengths of fabric from around her neck, she found herself drawn back to the dead face of the sleeper. The woman had not died tranquil. Her features had settled into an expression closer to determination than the peace of the grave. When rigor mortis developed, would it develop in this parody of a world? The hole might harden further into despair. The chin was firm, the jaw stubborn in its lines, the nasofrontal angle of the nose barely present, with flared nostrils like a large cat's. It was the jaw, and something about the eyes and brows that kept distracting Harrow. Something grey protruded from beneath a flap of the orange collar, against the dead skin of the sleeper's throat. She crouched down and used one finger to hook it. It was a loop of thin chain. She tugged carefully, and the rest emerged. Plain metal links, unadorned except for a flat steel tag about the length of her thumb. She turned the tag over. The other side had been neatly etched with a single word. Awake. Reverend daughter, Nonius said courteously. She stood and turned back to him. The long dead ghost of her house still looked a mess. He had returned his rapier and dagger to their respective sheaths, but his face and throat were ghastly with drying blood streaked here and there with sweat. His dark eyes were bloodshot, His hair was matted, and his split lip was swelling up. He left sticky red footprints wherever he walked. He said,
"Does aught of the foe yet remain? Are there enemies still who would hasten to harm you?"
"If there are, I don't know about them," she said. "Pent, can you sense anything left of the invasive presence?"
"Your soul is your own again, but the ghost will still, I suspect, have a corporeal foothold on the other side. Defeating it here will not have destroyed it there. The only sure way to banish a revenant is to destroy the physical anchor it inhabits before it can escape the shell. Inanimate objects can be destroyed, corpses too, if you remove the brain. But Harrow, we have other problems on our hands," said Abigail.
The sounds of the flesh strings hitting the floor had resolved into background noise. But now Canaan House rumbled again, not with any great ferociousness, but with a sort of timid, rattling unease, as though more of its facade was falling away. A sheet of dust fell from the ceiling, glittering softly in the white lights that winked off and on. The others looked up at the tumbling dust with varying shades of alarm, except for Abigail, who looked grimly expectant.
"Everyone listen. We don't have much time. The bubble is deforming," she said swiftly. "After multiple separate evolutions, there are too many places where it doesn't agree with itself."
Magnus said, "Another rearrangement? Will it cause a new scenario?"
"No," said his wife. "The memories have squared themselves away, and the intruder is gone. There is no more grit for the clam to worry into a pearl. And depending on what's happening outside, with all those external factors are driving the bubble to its natural end. We ghosts must head back to the river or risk getting absorbed or expelled by Harrow's soul."
Another low rumble from somewhere else, the far-off musical crash of some wall or partition slowly crumbling in on itself, a great particle mass sliding to a heap.
Nonius said instantly, "If I have discharged my duty to you and my house, I am bound by another, a debt from of old that I would repay if I can. May I leave these halls with your blessing, my lady?"
Ortus said intently,
"A debt?
A dread beast haunts this course of the river, a king among monsters," he said. "A rival and ally is fighting against it alone, and I grudge him the glory of such an impossible combat. Free me to aid him."
A terrible conviction seized Harrow Hark's heart. She had been here for what seemed like such a long time that she had put to one side the pressing issues of now. The reality that was out there still, and the fact that she was still alive despite her last coherent moments. A king among monsters in the river, and perhaps worse, the realization that she had lost a cherished and decade-long fight.
"You mean a lictor?" said Harrow. "You actually fought a lictor?"
"The third of the saints who serve as the hands of the Emperor Undying," he confirmed. And then, in case she'd missed the point, "the saint who is titled for duty."
"Why is he fighting alone?" she demanded.
A rising panic, strangely detached, was moving up the base of her spine.
"Where are Augustine and Mercy? Where's Ianthe?"
"I do not know these names. Even his own is beyond me. We met long ago and I fought him," said Nonius.
She very specifically did not look at Ortus. He was being good enough not to say anything. But if he looked at her with anything close to smugness, she was going to kick his ankle.
Another rumble from above, sounding much more insistent. Harrow said,
"But you're half dead already. The resurrection beast terrifies ghosts."
"I am not half dead," he said. "I am dead. Nothing more. But I am not afraid. This fight has sharpened my edge and awoken my senses. I am, if you like, warmed up, which, in context, I realize is not the best word choice."
Ortus said, "I will go with you,"
and instantly Protesilaus said,
"So will I."
"Ortus," said Harrowhark, "no,
You have no idea what you're speaking of. The beast in the river is the soul of a dead planet come to destroy the Emperor. If there's only one Lictor standing against it, he's dead, Nigenad. She could not have said anything worse. His eyes shone as he said,
I have lived so much of my life in fear, my Lady Harrowhark. I will not waste my death in it. I now find that I am no longer afraid of anything, of death, of laws, of monsters. I will advance before I can change my mind and become again a coward. Even if I cannot do anything more than watch, let me go.
In the face of her stupefaction, he added gently,
What else is there for me, Harrow?
And she knew that it was useless to hold him. Fearful, Ortis had proved enormously stubborn. It was inevitable that he would be even worse in bravery. She did not know what to say. Should she thank him? Thank him now? Cordially request he not go and waste his ghostly adrenaline on a creature he could not hope to understand? But Pent, more tactfully, was already speaking. I genuinely believe the river can be crossed, Nigenad. Come with me and Magnus. We could use your help in finding Jean-Marie and Isaac.
If there is a way through, you will undoubtedly find it, he said calmly. I am relieved that in my unworthy death, I was able to meet you. I will still write the Pentiad. It may just have to be a shorter poem. Very short, if what Harrow says is right. My heart is set to go with the hero of my own house and the hero of the Seventh.
I shall be glad to stand beside you, Ortis Nigenad. Never again will I doubt the will of the Ninth, said the unbelievably tedious hero of the Seventh, who then cleared his throat and said, In the storm, the tree is glad of the root, not of the branch.
Well expressed, said Ortis.
It's from a longer work of my own, admitted Protesilaus.
From behind them, Lieutenant Dias said, I'm going too. They all turned to look at her. Her injured hand was stoically clutching her rapier. Harrow noticed that she had tied the hilt to her glove with a length of wire so that it could not fall out of her grip. She was bloody, smeared and untidy, but perfectly calm.
I'm going, she repeated, and she shrugged. Cohort rules.
What cohort rule, Marta? Abigail asked, bewildered.
Chicken shits don't get beer, Dias said, and, after a pause, might not be the official wording, but that's how I've always heard it.
Magnus said, more than slightly delighted.
I have never heard that one.
As it happens, I have, said Matthias Nonius.
They all looked to Harrow as though on fatal cue. Legends, soldiers, poets, Magnus.
Nonius, Nigenad, I cannot in good faith hold you, she said finally. You have both served your house ably, and I thank you both. Nonius, if you owe something to the saint of duty, he could probably use your help. Go now. I have to get back as soon as possible myself.
He stepped back and bowed to her. It was an unpretentious, entirely modest movement. In the Noniad, it might have taken half a page. There was no time for him to make any kind of speech. But despite over 12 books of Ortis celebrating his verbosity, he did not seem the type of man to make one. All he said was,
Many thanks and farewell. Spirit guide of the Fifth, can you send us four to the shore's edge?
Easily, Abigail said. She stepped forward and put one hand on Protesilaus's and Ortis's shoulders, and she peered through her thick glasses at them and said quickly, Are you...
For the Seventh, said Protesilaus.
For the Second, said Marta.
For the Ninth,
said Ortis. The candles flared up again, the black flame threatening to scorch the ceiling, and Canaan House seemed to rock again as though with some earthquake. The electric lights overhead flickered and died briefly, and all four cavaliers were gone, back into the river. Harrow found herself imagining them in her mind's eye, rising out of those turbid waters before the saint of duty with his spear and his sword, something looming behind him, bigger than the eye could comprehend, bluer than death, unimaginable, advancing to greet the four dead swordsmen and the lictor. She had not said goodbye. Harrow so rarely got to say goodbye. The lights flickered again. A fine haze was rising from the grill beneath their feet, carrying a thin suggestion of smoke. The candles had gone out entirely, and their thin, satiny souls were rising to heaven in the metal rafters. There was a pervasive, clinging smell of burning dust and the continuous rumbling of softly piling rock and bending metal. They stared at each other with a left-behind, exhausted bemusement. Harrowhark and the ghosts of Dulcinea Septimus, Magnus Quinn, and Abigail Pent. With rising agitation that she could not quite quell, Harrow found herself asking curtly, "What's my role in this exodus, Pent?" "If you stay, there's no question of you absorbing yourself or expelling yourself," said Abigail, and there was something quite careful in the way she said it. "You're the host soul, and can only be displaced willingly, or with the kind of violence the sleeper attempted. Spirits always wish to return to their bodies and pine without them. The only exits for you now are the river, leaving your body completely, or you can simply go home and wake up." Gideon. It had bewildered her back at Canaan House how the whole of her always seemed to come back to Gideon. For one brief and beautiful space of time, she had welcomed it, that microcosm of eternity between forgiveness and the slow, uncomprehending agony of the fall. Gideon rolling up her shirt sleeves, Gideon dappled in shadow, breaking promises. One idiot with a sword and an asymmetrical smile had proved to be Harrow's end. Her apocalypse swifter than the death of the Emperor and the Sun with him. She could let herself go, or she could go back to her body and let her go. Nav had made it her decision when it came to imminent death either way. The free will to say, "Harrow dies or Harrow lives." And she had said, albeit fuck her for saying it, "Harrow lives," which required its opposite balance. "Gideon dies." Now here she was back again with what she had always wanted. The choice to say yes and the choice to say no, with the needle of no sliding fatally back toward yes. She said, "If I go back, it will finally destroy her soul." It was Magnus who stepped forward and looked at Harrow face to face, and perhaps she felt that more keenly, that he was the man who had, in Gideon's own words a lifetime ago, been nice to her cavalier. His mouth was hard now, but his eyes were as kind as they had ever been, and kindness was a knife. "This whole thing happened because you wouldn't face up to Gideon dying," he said, which was a stab as precise as any Nonius had managed. "I don't blame you, but where would you be right now if you'd said, 'She is dead?' You're keeping her things like a lover keeping old notes, but with her death, the stuff that made her Gideon was destroyed. That's how lictorhood works, isn't it? She died. She can't come back, even if you keep her stuffed away in a drawer you can't look at. You're not waiting for her resurrection. You've made yourself her mausoleum." His wife looked at Harrow's face and murmured, "Magnus, you've made your point." But he uncharacteristically ignored her. "Do you know, Abigail broke up with me when we were 17. I kept a ripped-up corner of her dance card for 3 years. It didn't even have any writing on it, or her initials, or mine, just a ripped-up corner of card." One of the lights detached from the ceiling above them with a trailing shower of sparks and shattered on the grill beneath. To Harrow, it sounded like a tolling bell.
This is your ripped-up corner of card, said Magnus. You're a smart girl, Harrowhark. You might turn some of that brain to the toughest lesson, that of grief. The drizzling dust had become a blizzard, and something buckled against the whiteboard wall. If the destruction of Kanan House kept progressing at this rate, even if it was some kind of metaphorical shift, it would, in a very unmetaphorical sense, squash everyone flat. Rules were rules. If a chunk of her psychological landscape fell on Abigail or Dulcie or Magnus, it would be a second death. Their spirits would be erased from existence, never able even to enter the river. They clustered closer toward her, like plants sensing sunlight. As though she were the eye of the storm, the destruction seemed to revolve around her, and the ground beneath their feet was still. Harrowhark found herself studying Dulcie's face. There was a strange, tucked-in stillness that made her old again, those fine sigil wrinkles on either side of the mouth that told her own lesson of suffering. Harrow said, "Then there is the river." "The river means madness," said Abigail immediately. "You've never been there as an unanchored soul. You don't know what it's like. I haven't the faintest idea of what would happen to the secondary soul in a literal bond if the host soul abandons the body." "You are alive, Harrowhark. That does mean something where souls are concerned. Your soul longs for your body, and without something else to inhabit, I could not even promise that in your madness you wouldn't somehow find your way back, rendering all this moot." Even with her feelings schooled, Harrow's voice sounded feeble and childlike and plaintive. "Is there nothing I can do before entering the river that might mean I stay put?" "No," said Abigail. "It's the river. It moves. You have to pick the revenant's path and travel along a thanagetic link. And that's just madness again. Sitting inside, I don't know, a teapot, clinging on without sense or understanding, going slowly insane. And as I said, your soul longs for your body. What if you lose yourself to eventual madness and are reabsorbed, leading to some kind of mélange? You know what teacher was, a patchwork fusion between your soul and fragments of Gideon's. Harrowhark, you stand before a known quantity and hideous unknowns. Don't walk back toward the unknown." "If it were me," Magnus said, "I'd go home and live for her." There was a terrific crash from out in the corridor, followed by a hideous creaking as, close by, a girder came down. The noise was awesome. It was as though the world were screaming and bending all about them. The fifth house spirit caller lost her reserve and took Harrow's hands in her own and said, "I'm so sorry, Harrow. I wish it were different. I am so tremendously sorry." The ceiling above them buckled and shuddered, but held. Harrow looked at the stricken faces before her, at the now somber lines of the Cavalier of the Fifth, his jolly face achieving a certain supernatural dignity. His historian wife, a woman whom she now knew could never be properly avenged. The tragedy of the genius and the useless death, the irreparable loss to the universe. As though the universe could withstand more holes, as though the fabric of the universe had not become a series of lacework cutouts linked by the thin, snappable joins of those who remained. Could the pattern sustain itself with such absences? Could she, who had once thought herself well-versed in absence, endure alone? The answer was so obviously no. She was not even ready to have the question put to her. And yet, Harrowhark said, "You've got to go before the roof comes down on you." Abigail gave a weary, rueful half-smile, a very fifth house embarrassment. "Not until you tell me what you're doing. In loco parentis, you see. I'm afraid I feel responsible for you and need you to promise me you'll live." "Gideon decided that for me," said Harrow. She was not really afraid. It was only that her hands were,
and was shaking independent of her feelings. The first falling chunk of ceiling landed with heavy, balletic stillness, causing them all to stumble from the shockwave. Abigail, Dulcie, and Harrow momentarily cowered beneath the automatic and totally useless arm Magnus had thrown over them, a sort of optimistic human umbrella. Harrow Hark said briskly,
"Pint, Quinn, Septimus, I'm poor with thanks and worse at goodbyes, therefore I won't bother with them."
Magnus said, "Have you—"
"Someday I'll die and get buried in the ground and you can take it up with me then," said Harrow, and found, after all, that she was not really speaking to them. "Until then, I'm afraid that I have to live."
"Then this is not goodbye," said Abigail, and she reached forward to brush a stray lock of hair behind Harrow Hark's ear, which was an instinct Harrow could not find it within herself to feel humiliated by.
"I believe that we will see each other again," Magnus said quickly.
"Jean said to tell Gideon hi, if you see her before we do.
Though try not to with any great hurry," said the fifth spirit caller.
And then that same blue shimmer and they were gone, without fanfare, leaving her alone, with Dulcinea Septimus. The soft ripples within the bubbles had not claimed the seventh. She stood there amid the falling dust and the noises of shrieking steel, her skin like thin, awful gossamer, and her short, sugar-brown curls stuck to her scalp with the ghost of sweat and blood. Harrow Hark, bewildered and stricken, drew closer to her as the world fell all around them.
"Oops, it's me again, never doing what I'm told," said Dulcie. "One more moment, please."
Harrow said, curt with bemusement,
"Hurry up and go. If I ever stand before Palamedes Sextus again, I have no desire to explain to him why I put Dulcinea Septimus back in danger.
I'm going to risk staying here for a moment and getting squashed into nothingness instead, actually," she said. "The seventh says nothingness is the only truly beautiful thing anyway, so nya. Septimus, if this is about ensuring I get back into my body safely, you can trust me not to change my mind."
Dulcinea, with that strange face that was at once the twin to Kithareia's, and yet nothing like it, smiled an extraordinarily rueful little smile that never would have fit the lictor's face. She reached up and clasped one of Harrow's hands between her own as one of the corridors to their left came down completely.
"Actually, I've got something to tell you," she said.